Hello, and thank you for joining this presentation at the Quantum to Cosmos Festival at Perimeter Institute. Welcome to those of you here in this room and those of you joining us online from around the world. Before we begin the lecture, can we just remind you of a few things? Those in the theater, please turn off your BlackBerries and cell phones. And those of you, please go ahead and share this presentation with your friends by emailing them the website, q2cfestival.com, and you can also follow this event on Twitter. Our guest today is Dr. Neil Gershenfeld, who I first met when he came to South Africa. And Neil, for me, it was quite a revelation to see his talk, because as a kid, I always loved to make things, electric motors and gadgets and play with pipes and water and things like that. And in the modern age, kids spend an awful lot of time online and seem to be less interested in making things. Well, in some ways, the future will be a return to making things as the limits of miniaturization are reached and we start to actually to have to use the physical properties of atoms from which to construct computers of the future. And Neil is an absolute pioneer in this respect. He works on the boundary between computer science and physical science. He's worked on quantum computation, and he's most widely known for the concept of the Fab Lab. And here is his book called Fab. He'll describe exactly what that will mean for the future. And today he'll tell us more about this interface between abstract bits and concrete atoms. So please join me in welcoming Dr. Neil Gershenfeld.
Thanks, Neil. It's a pleasure to be here. So in the next, not quite an hour, I'd like to talk about how the digital world relates to the physical world. And I'm going to start with some fairly fundamental questions that may sound very abstract, and then progress for their consequences, ending with, for me, very, very surprising and very personal implications of what I'll be talking about. So I want to start by looking at how the world inside a computer relates to the world outside a computer. These are some of the world's biggest machines. This is Japan's Earth simulator that fills a building about the size of this building and runs models of the weather. This is BlueJean at Livermore, which has been until recently the fastest computer on Earth, modeling proteins. It's also used to model more explosive things. So these machines model nature, but they also are nature. They're physical systems. This shows the installation of the Cray-1, one of the first supercomputers. And this whole base was full of heat transfer to get the heat out of it. And the core was full of wires carefully trimmed to the right length. So these system builders and installers think of these as physical systems that are then used to model all these other worlds. But this is getting harder and harder to do. Japan has a project for a successor that was a $1 billion computer, and the lead companies just gave up. They just decided they couldn't actually make this thing. If you look at how these big computers are growing, they're approaching $1 billion. One of them takes 30 megawatts, the power of a city. The programmers are beginning to riot. It's increasingly hard to program them. There's bottlenecks all over the place. It's just getting harder and harder to make those systems. And what I'd like to argue is it all dates back to a profound insight that was a mistake decades ago. So the modern model of computing emerged from a number of people, but a seminal role was Alan Turing, who formalized what a computer is. In the 30s, with a Turing machine, which was a head that could read a tape, read symbols, and modify the symbols. And that formal model of a computer as a head reading a tape has influenced many models of computing since. In particular, following that, in the 40s, John von Neumann, developed a concrete programming model in the ENIAC machine where there was a memory, and then there was a control unit, an arithmetic unit, reading and writing to that memory that was essentially making Turing's machine electronically. And so, abstractly, the Turing machine, concretely, von Neumann's programming model, are how computers largely work today. And those big machines I showed you descend from that. But if you look at nature, nature doesn't work that way. In each of these systems, everything is happening everywhere all the time. There isn't a separation between memory and processing and communication. Stuff happens everywhere, always, that give you this enormous range of behavior and the complexity of the natural world. And that really isn't captured by a Turing machine or a von Neumann architecture. And so the mistake 30 years ago was for computer science and physical science to diverge. And ever since, computer scientists have been programming in an abstract world free of the limitations of physics, while the system builders have been scrambling to try to maintain that fiction and let them continue to pretend they live in a different universe. But eventually that universe is leaking back in. And so it's getting harder and harder to pretend you can compute in a world any other than the world we live in. Now, our world is an amazing computer. This is a fun paper Seth Lloyd wrote on the computational power of the universe. And I forget the units, 120,000 ops on, 10 to the 120 ops on 10 to the 90 bits is the power of the whole universe, if you think of it as one big computing machine. So nature is a computer in every sense that computer means. There are deep theoretical reasons why models of nature use computational language. Assume you have a lattice and have discrete states for theoretical reasons. There's also very good practical reasons. So if you want to model, for example, a fluid, like I showed a few pictures ago, this is a very different way to model a fluid, where instead of writing equations on a piece of paper, you can define a lattice, and each site has a few simple states and a few simple rules. It's like playing a game of checkers or a game of life. And with just these few rules, locally, you can reproduce the equations that Navier and Stokes found many years ago, but in a version that's designed not for the information technology of the 1700s, a piece of paper, but for a computer. So you can model nature as discrete states interacting on a lattice. In turn, this was a beautiful thesis written in the 70s at MIT by Roger Banks, who had Ed Fredkin and Marvin Minsky as his thesis committee. And he asked just a theoretical question, which is, can a cellular automata, which is what I was describing, discrete states on a lattice interacting, compute anything? Can those simple states do any computation? And Banks showed that the answer is yes. And the way he did it was by showing you can implement universal logic in a cellular automata. So this was before there were computers easily available to simulate. He did a lot of this by hand. He had only three rules, that each of these describes how a neighborhood updates its state based on its neighbors. And just using those three rules, this is what a signal looks like in a wire. This is how signals turn corners. And then this very funny shape, he found, implements a logic gate. So he showed with this system, you can do logic, therefore a cellular automata can compute anything. And that's been just a little quiet corner. These Norman, Tom, Margulis, and Toffoli made a series of machines that didn't work like the computer on your desktop, but used these cellular automata rules for things like simulation very efficiently. And what's interesting about that approach is it's a description of computation that doesn't look like what Turing or von Neumann taught us, but looks more like what Maxwell and Boltzmann taught us, that information scales. So if you have twice as much stuff in nature, you have twice as much information. And so that argues that a computer should have a uniform substrate that grows as you add material. Our universe also is causal. Things can't go faster than the speed of light. And so that means that interactions should be local, and you shouldn't assume there's a global clock coordinating everything. So the computer on your desktop doesn't do any of that. And that's what's beginning to bite us on this larger and larger scale. Conversely, if you ask, why don't we rewind 30 years ago and say, let's do this all this over again, and redo computer science so it looks like physical science, it turns out not only is that tractable, in many ways it's much easier to do. So with a number of colleagues, we've been developing a version called Reconfigurable Asynchronous Logic Automata, and I'll explain each of those letters. In this kind of computation, there are cells on a lattice. Some of the cells can do logic, and then what they do is they pass tokens around, and tokens are little chunks of information, and each cell waits for tokens to arrive in and then pushes tokens out, and then there are cell types that can create and destroy these tokens and can transport them and can reconfigure them. And so if you look, you'll see a little bit of blinking here. This is a computer program that's sorting numbers, and it can actually sort numbers for experts in a time linear in the number of numbers, which is faster than a conventional computer. And it does it by just the numbers or tokens flying through this world, implementing the sort. Or here's a bigger example. Multiplying matrices is a very important mathematical operation. And you count how long it takes based on the number of entries in the matrix. And if you do it the naive way, just by adding and multiplying, it takes n squared. If you do it efficiently for some problems, it takes n times the log of n. In this world, it takes only order n, because the operations is the distance the information travels. So each of these is an adder and a multiplier. And what you'll see is this shows you the matrices flying through this world. And you're essentially implementing not lines of code, but kind of the flow of information through the problem. You're taking the way you write the symbols on a piece of paper and taking the flow of information through the piece of paper and actually making that a computational medium. So what's interesting about the world is we're doing this on many scales. This is being written as code for multi-core computers. It's being virtualized in arrays of $1 microcontrollers. We're designing ASICs that do this natively. We're prototyping this with molecular logic, where these are nanostructures. But because the computer program is described in this way, each of these units is time, space, state, and logic. So it means the distance you travel equals the time it takes, equals the amount of information you store, equals the amount of operations you can do. In physics, those are coupled. In computer science, they're counted separately. And in turn, that means the same program can run on any of these systems. The software doesn't change for these wildly different hardware because they all are governed by the laws of physics. It means you don't need to make one big system, you make lots of little tiny systems. It only uses energy where something's happening. The rest of the system doesn't use energy to sit there and do nothing. You travel through the system at the speed of the physics, not at the speed of trying to choreograph it. In all sorts of ways, it turns out it's much easier to build systems this way by aligning the computation with the physics. So this is going surprisingly quickly. And in fact, I have a bet with my students that a year from now, next January, I have to stop using desktop computers and do all my email and word processing in this world. And I think we'll be far enough along to make that. Now, this will turn computing into a raw material. So you'll buy a computer not by speccing the processor and the memory, but just on a scale. You'll say how many pounds or how many feet of computing you want and put it in whatever shape you want. And that's not a joke. That's a very serious projection. But in turn, that means if you know, this is the computer doing this presentation instead of the computer I carried in, you can't assume there's an operating system that can reach in from outside to make things happen. You have to somehow tell this to run a program. So the R in RALA is reconfiguration for how programs grow in this world. And so here's an example of a program streaming in from this cell that then is growing a series of little computational structures. And so the cells can configure their neighbors. Here's a more interesting example. This is a little replicator. That loop on the top takes some tokens coming in, and then it keeps copying them. So it's like a replicator that reproduces a structure over and over again. And so by using those sort of operations, the system can grow parts of the program completely internal without assuming something else is running the computer. So the operating system, in effect, grows with the rest of the system. Now, that, not surprisingly, is suggestive of biology, because the inspiration is very similar, and they're solving a similar problem. This is my favorite protein. It's the ribosome. The ribosome reads a code. A messenger RNA comes in with a code for what to construct. Transfer RNA grab amino acids. The ribosome bolts them together and pushes them out, and it makes the molecular machinery in me or you. So there's actin and kinesin filaments making my fingers move, or photosystem 1 getting the photons in my eye. Those amazing, exquisite molecular machines are made here, where the ribosome is taking a code and turning it into a shape. And that's the inspiration, and that's what was implemented in that model of computation I showed you. And the observation that you can do that doesn't come from us. That goes all the way back to von Neumann. Late in life, long after the ENIAC and the von Neumann architecture, he started thinking about, does all this computing stuff tell us anything about life? And so the last thing he did, and he never finished this monograph, is try to make a mathematical model of life. And that led him to look at self-reproducing automata. And so he invented an early version of the sort of world I showed you, and abstractly designed these kinds of mathematical machines that could reproduce themselves. So two interesting things about that. One is, why did he do it? In this unfinished monograph, he described it as he was looking at the role of high and extremely high complication. He wanted to ask, how do you create the complexity of life? Computer programs, computers then couldn't make anything remotely as complex as you and me. So he was asking, how do you create this complexity? And he invented this world because there just wasn't the means to do it in the world of atoms. So he invented this world of simulation. So the next step down this path is we're now at a point technologically where you can do this not just for computation, but to change the world around us. So there's a large program we're involved in that's either ambitiously or modestly, depending on your perspective, trying to re-implement life in completely engineered materials. So take everything I've been describing, and now implement it in a material set different from biology so we can code for construction. And so to do that, we've essentially had to re-implement sort of the whole development of life, but in these new worlds we're creating. So a colleague, Jonathan Bachrach, did this beautiful job of developing CAD tools. It's hard to predict how a protein will fold, but since we're kind of folding these structures, if we design them, you can design structures that fold into a desired shape. And so this is from a CAD tool. And what it lets you do is start with the shape you want and fold it. So those are all examples of you can start with an engineering design environment and think of something you want to make, but instead of sending it to a machine to cut it out, you can mathematically send it into a string and have the string turn into the shape you want, just like proteins fold. And we're in the process of implementing that over 9 orders of magnitude. We're doing it in DNA, in nanostructures, in microfluidics, in micro machines, all the way up to people size and bigger parts. So this was one of the early examples. This is centimeter squared parts. This is a short string of one of these strings that can fold into arbitrary shapes. Just prototyping the construction. This is a version done with micro machining. So this is a kind of a roll-to-roll robot with microstructures and involving a new kind of motor that was invented for this project that lets you make these systems as a continuous process, long strings that can fold into arbitrary shapes. And on still smaller scales, to implement the kind of world I'm describing, this is a kind of computer, but each bit, instead of being electrons, is a bubble. So these are microstructures, and what you're looking at is, this is a memory. So this is a memory toggling between one and zero. This is logic. Each of these are logic gates, and this is high-speed video, slowed way down so you can see it. And based on how the bubbles arrive, they come out on one side or the other, and that lets it do a logical operation. This is what's called a ring oscillator. Here, a bubble triggers a bubble, which triggers a bubble. And this one is a synchronizer. This lets a slow bubble catch up to a fast bubble. Now, if any of you have studied digital logic, you'll know those are all the things you need for any logic family. So this computer uses CMOS, and chip designers design the chips. These do all the things you need. There's nonlinearity, gain, fan out. It's all the things any logic family does. But here, the logic family, each bit transports information, but it also transports material. So the same skills of digital logic design now let you design things that print or combust or construct, where the information is simultaneously materials. And finally now, if you step back and look at where is all that heading, the conclusion is we're at the edge of a very interesting moment. In the 40s, telephones were analog. Phone calls got worse with distance. Claude Shannon digitized them. He wrote an amazing master's thesis at MIT. He then went to Bell Labs. And he showed that if you digitize, meaning precisely you add information to a signal and then remove it later to restore the state, instead of errors decreasing, you get a threshold, and below that threshold, the error rate effectively goes to zero. And that wasn't really appreciated at the time. When he was at Bell Labs, he was arguing phones should be digital, and the phone company management said, no, there are a lot of reasons not to do it, analog is better. And the battle was finally won when they died off and a new generation of managers took over, and we had a digital phone system, and now we have the internet that lets people watch this at home. So that's familiar. Computers were analog. Vannevar Bush at MIT made the last great analog computer. This is a room full of pulleys and gears, and the longer this ran, the worse the answer got. A bigger group, including von Neumann and Winograd and Cowan, digitized computing in the 50s. They showed if you take what Shannon taught us, but you apply it to a computer, you can compute without errors, effectively. And so that what lets you put a billion transistors in a Pentium, and the billionth transistor is as useful as the first one, unlike older analog computers where there's a severe limit to the size because of errors accumulating. So that's the digital revolution, but it's over. We won, those are done. However, now look at the world around us. This was the first computer connected to a machine tool. This was at MIT's Servo Mechanism Laboratory. That was done in the 50s, but little has changed since then. This Boeing's state-of-the-art 787 airplane, the only difference is you melt plastic instead of bashing metal. You design it in a computer, but there's no information in the materials. If you look at a state-of-the-art chip fab, a village artisan would understand the process. What you do is you spread stuff around and you bake it. That's the fundamental operation done to make chips. They can become chips, but the information isn't in the chip. It's external to the system. If you looked at all the systems I've been showing you, the difference is the program isn't describing a thing. The program itself is a thing. The computation isn't done by a computer controlling a tool. The computer is the tool. The information is integral to the system. Bits and atoms isn't a metaphor. It's fundamentally connected. Viewed this way, the most deep insight into life is this. Life codes to construct. The ribosome makes an error rate of 10 to the minus 4. When you duplicate DNA, it adds an extra level of error correction. It costs more energy to do it, but it does it because that's an important function, and the error rate is 10 to the minus 8. If you do an ordinary analog chemical reaction, the error rate is like 0.1 or 0.01. So life builds by coding construction. You're full of information that makes you possible. You're not made by an external tool fabricating a baby. The information is internal to the baby. And what we're realizing is we're just at the edge of this digital revolution in fabrication where you can code construction. In retrospect, it's exactly parallel to the transition from analog to digital communications and analog to digital computation. But now it means taking the information out of the world in the computer and bringing it out here where we live. So the research roadmap is leading to the Star Trek replicator. In 20 or so years, we expect to make something that makes anything. But long before then, this is going to have a huge impact. And this was all a great surprise for me. So these were early personal computers. You now certainly know that the killer app of digital computing is personal computing. Ken Olson, the head of digital equipment, famously said, nobody needs a computer in the home. And he was implicitly saying, who's going to do inventory and payroll at home? DEC is bankrupt. In fact, it's twice over bankrupt. Compaq bought DEC and HP bought Compaq. And you have computers in the home, but they're not for inventory and payroll. They're for what excites you. In the same sense, digital fabrication enables personal fabrication. I first realized that when I was teaching a class called How to Make Almost Anything. And this was not provocative. This was to train students to do research on all the machines we had bought to do the work I'm describing. But 100 people showed up for a class with room for 10 people, and they were there not for research, they just wanted to make stuff. And then they did the most amazing things. Kelly was a sculptor. She didn't have a conventional engineering background. They did semester projects integrating what they had learned in the class, and this was hers.
Hi, I'm Kelly, and this is my screen body. Do you ever find yourself in a situation where you really have to scream, but you can't because you're at work, or you're in a classroom, or you're watching your children, or you're in any number of situations where it's just not permitted? Well, Screen Body is a portable space for screaming. When a user screams into Screen Body, their scream is silent. But it is also recorded for later release, where, when, and how the user chooses.
I'm going to the main building, up to the second floor.
Now, you laugh, which is reasonable, but notice to do that, she designed a circuit board, she fabbed the circuit board, she stuffed the parts, she wrote the microcode, she worked with piezo-resistive squeeze sensors and acoustic foam. But she didn't do that as a business model. She just did that because she wanted one. Another student made a web browser for parrots. Parrots have the cognitive ability of a young child. They go crazy left home alone. It let the parrots talk to other parrots and their owners. This student made an alarm clock that you had to wrestle with and prove to it that you were awake. This student made a dress instrumented with spines that defends your personal space. And this happened so consistently that I finally came to appreciate the students were answering this question I hadn't asked, which is, what is all of this stuff good for? And the answer is personal fabrication. It's not to buy what you can buy at Walmart. I see a giant one coming down the road. It's to buy what you can't buy at that Walmart. It's things for a market of one person. It's your expression in technology. We create nests. We customize our world. But we've ended up at this point where you shop at Amazon or Walmart. And so this ability to create your own environment touches something much deeper than I've ever seen in any technology. So in turn, we started setting these up in the field, and that was even more unexpected.
In search of solutions for the world we share. Principal Voices, in association with Shell.
We've had a digital revolution, but we don't need to keep having it. We can declare success, we won. What's coming now is the digital revolution in fabrication. My colleagues and I started teaching a class called How to Make Almost Anything. And the idea was just that. It's a program looking at how the digital world relates to the physical world. And one of the core things coming out of the research is the idea of digital fabrication, making the Star Trek replicator, an assembler that makes anything you want by building the atoms on up. This is designed where you put in the ribbon. Millions of dollars of equipment at MIT are like the mainframes of digital fabrication. We can make anything we want using those tools. In 20 years, we'll make it so you can have it in the home. The fab labs are in between. They spread all around the world, letting ordinary people create technology from South Africa to the north of Norway and from rural India to inner city Boston. Instead of spending vast amounts of money to send computers and energy and communication around the world, you can spend much less to send the means to create it. Energy, communication, computation, just to say the words, they sound big. They're being tackled as billion-dollar mega projects top down. Fab Labs is tackling them from the bottom up. We're just finding so many people with such interesting inventions and such great ideas. Sharing that is where I see this going.
Principal Voices, in association with Shell.
So all of that was an accident. When you spend as much tax money as I had spent, the government says you have to do social outreach, and it just didn't sound so exciting to make a website or a class. So we had adventurous NSF program managers, and I proposed we set up the tools. And you can think of the ones we're using at MIT as like mainframes. They're millions of dollars, and we have this PC coming. The Fab Labs you can think of as they're like mini computers. In between mainframes and PCs came DEC PDPs, was the era of machines that were tens of thousands of dollars. They weren't yet for one person, they were hard to use, but that's when email, the internet, everything you do on computing largely happened, because a work group could use it. And so these Fab Labs are exactly that cost and complexity. They're not yet cheap and easy enough for one person to use, but one typical person, but a small group can use them, and with it you can approximate what you'll do with a Star Trek replicator when it comes in 20 years, but you can do it today. And so we set one up in Boston. There's a strong Ghanaian connection, and so it went from there to here. This is Sekundi Takoradi in the coast of Ghana. And this is a typical picture. One seat might have 10 bottoms in it. Then there's a strong South African connection. This is in Soshanguve, a shanty town outside Pretoria. This is in Pabal, in a poor, dry part of western Maharashtra in India. This is in Jalalabad in Afghanistan. I didn't wake up at MIT and think Eastern Afghanistan or Western India needs precision fab tools. Each case, they were pulled, and they were pulled not by a digital divide on the computer screen, but by a divide in instrumentation and fabrication, by a desire for these people to measure and modify the world around them. And so there's a kind of a flow. Again, this isn't our idea. But what would happen was a flow through these labs where it starts with just empowerment. These were young girls in inner city Boston who did high-tech rapid prototyping on a street corner and did a craft sale with computer-controlled laser cutting. And they made a few hundred dollars in an afternoon, but much more than that, there's just this joy of, I can do this. Then hands-on education. The same thing that was happening in that class at MIT was happening in the field. We had designed, when we set up the lab in Ghana, a networked sensor, and there was an 8-year-old girl who wouldn't leave the lab until she could do it. So the clip you'll see was taken late at night.
Go on inside. also maybe 1K kalo.
Valentina Kofi. I am 8 years old. I made a stacking board.
So she had fabbed the board. You saw her stuffing it. She was about to load the microcode. How many of you know how to do all of that? So she, in a very real sense, this young girl in Sekundi Takoradi, a coastal fishing village in Ghana, isn't catching up to Waterloo. She's skipping over this generation to do that directly. Then these little outreach labs that weren't meant to be useful started tackling useful projects. This was instrumentation for agriculture in India and energy conversion in Africa, and I'll talk about the networking in a minute. Then from there, they started doing larger and larger projects. And so this was a project using Fab Lab tools to do rapid prototyping of housing. Making a house on demand with custom parts in a few thousand dollars of materials. And then research started going backwards. This was supposed to be outreach, but a fun example is these are parts in a 3D construction kit that my, at the time, 8-year-old daughter invented, Grace. I was teaching her to use the tools. She loved the tools. She thought my projects were dumb. And so she instead took a cardboard box. And I helped her get the dimensions right, but invent this 3D construction kit. Then my son Eli helped get the design the set of parts. But the interesting thing was I had a grad student work on scaling additive assembly of digital parts to microstructures. And he had a pretty cumbersome design. And so he looked at Grace's design and realized that was a much easier to make space-filling 3D structures. And so these are parts from his thesis that were based on the work of an 8-year-old girl. That there was a real back action from what was happening in the field to what we were doing back on campus. So just some examples of projects in the lab. The one in Jalalabad in Afghanistan, one of the biggest issues is telecom infrastructure that was largely non-existent. And so there, they're using the rapid prototyping tools to make high-gain antennas customized to links. And then this is a satellite picture where they're deploying wide-area telecom infrastructure from the bottom up as a community project. And then in turn, populating this with both a satellite link out, but also servers locally caching MIT's open courseware and Wikipedia and things like that. Just full of epiphanies of people getting access to information and saying, I didn't know that about the world. Or this was a project that started with collaborators in South Africa. There are a number of attempts to try to make a $100 people computer to solve the planet's problems. They're coming out more like $200 than $100. And the model is technical heroes far away come up with this great computer and then drop it, and then good things are supposed to happen. Instead, this is an internet terminal that you can make for $10 in parts. That's just enough to connect to the internet using a TV as a display in the lab. It's only $10 to make. And then instead of mass producing these, you can do high rate production by not doing it in one place, but by doing it in a lot of other little places locally on demand. And in turn, that means skills and jobs can be local. And in turn, it means instead of one computer for everybody, you can have different ones for different languages and different skills and different body shapes and types. So bottom-up computing instead of top-down computing. This is one of the most exciting ones. This is work on using the rapid prototyping tools to make the rapid prototyping tools. At the beginning of this presentation, I described a deep sense of self-reproducing systems, where you make a vat of stuff and what you want walks out of it. This is the short-term version. So Max and Alan here We just opened a lab in Pune, India, and I had sent them over. And the job in the first week was to get the lab running, and then the job in the second week was to make the machine. So they just arrived with data. They made the lab, and this is a rapid prototyping tool. And this shows the tool they made making a circuit board. And the circuit board it's making is a very important one. This is a motor controller that you can use to make the motor control for the next machine you're going to make. Then what's interesting about this is it's actually doing it with higher performance than the tool we send in the field that cost about $4,000, and this was about $400 in parts. And then this is a smaller generation still. This is a few hundred dollars where this machine makes parts like that, 2D or 3D parts, and in turn, Jonathan here is making a bigger version of this machine sized to make that machine so that the machines can spread virally. So we're really just at the point, these need consumables like a microcontroller. We're not yet at the point of making that in the field, but given that small set of high-tech consumables, you can really start self-reproducing the tools. The tools can make the tools so this spreads virally. All of that is much too big for an outreach project. At this point, every day I get a message, I want a fab lab from all over Earth, and about once a week I get these very difficult to answer messages, I'm canceling my life, where do I report? And I just didn't have a good answer. So this is this lab above the Arctic Circle, a few hundred miles above it, but if you look at this, it has the kind of tools I came to MIT for, it has broadband connectivity, so I see people there more than my time-stressed MIT colleagues. Libraries are certainly online. So to keep up with all of that, increasingly, what I'm coming to appreciate is the machines will make the machines. That's progressing well. The meta project is how do you live, work, and play in a world where anybody can make anything anywhere. And it really breaks all of our organizational boundaries. So we tried to work with foundations doing aid to keep up with this demand all over Africa, Middle East, South Asia. But the problem is aid agencies are sort of constitutionally risk-averse. You develop a vaccine, prove efficacy, and field it. If what you're fielding is invention, it's kind of hard to prove the efficacy of invention in that traditional sense. And further, the skill set you need is technical. So we ended up having to create a foundation, which is really a network link of local foundations, to start to develop the operational capacity to support this. Then, and I didn't expect this, we had to start working on creating a fund. Silicon Valley happened because of venture capitalism, but that was based on you'd make a pilgrimage to Sand Hill Road to pitch to Kleiner Perkins. Something like a $400 self-reproducing machine or a $10 internet terminal are great businesses. They're high tech, but they don't need tens of millions of dollars. They need tens of thousands of dollars, and it needs to happen all over the planet. And further, the way you go to market is not by finishing the design and then sending it to Guangdong and having a factory crank them out. You go global by sending data and then producing local. And that just doesn't fit the business model of VCs. It also doesn't fit the business model of microfinance. Grameen Bank has transformed things like women's cooperatives, but it's banking. You price an asset. It's not speculative technical risk. So we've had to develop funds. And then the biggest surprise was education. We had to develop a degree program. And for the longest time, I pushed this off. This was going too far. This is an out-of-control outreach project. But now it was starting to go beyond where it belonged. But over time, I've come to realize this is really, for me, the ultimate implication. This is an essay I wrote on, is MIT obsolete? And I conclude about half of it is not, but half of it is. And the reason is, if you look at MIT, it's all based on scarcity. It assumes the machines are scarce, so you have to limit access to them. It assumes the people are scarce, so you have to limit access to them, and the books are scarce. So the net result is you're all packed in a little place where it's very hard to get space and everybody fights over each square foot. Costs are huge. We pay 63% overhead to do anything in that constrained space. It's productive, it's effective, it's had a great legacy, But maybe half of what you do at a place like MIT, you can now do in places like I'm showing you here. The other half really does need the resources there. So all around the world, we started finding these amazing kids, like Hans Christian in the lab in Norway was a 14-year-old boy who, in one day, did all the demonstration projects I do in a semester with my rapid prototyping class at MIT. And the next time I saw him, he had designed a robot truck from scratch, including the motor control and the 3D design and the display. And just over and over, we found those amazing kids around the world. So here's Hans Christian a few hundred miles above the Arctic Circle, so far ahead of his local school, ahead of many of the students I was teaching at MIT. What do you do with him? The traditional career path is to say, you're smart, now you have to go away. So he has to leave wherever he is and go off to somewhere remote to get an education. But he has the tools there, he has this video network, he has the online libraries. And so this Fab Academy grew not as central learning where you all pack into one place, not as distance learning where you have a hub and everybody is a spoke from that, but taking the whole planet as a campus. So students are in these critical masses of work groups, but the critical mass is tens, not tens of thousands. And then they're globally linked in this shared video space where we have lectures. We time it so the lecture is 6 a.m. in California and 11 p.m. in Japan and goes all the way around the Earth. And we have labs all around the world connecting for these global lectures. And then in the labs, these work groups do the local problems. And we're in the process of accrediting a global campus. Now, it's hard to accredit because the accreditation bodies aren't global, but they've been very receptive to this. And ultimately, a goal for this is to make my job obsolete. Not in the next couple years, but 5-10 years from now, you won't need people like me doing what I do at MIT. Advanced education and research will become a fundamentally distributed process. So right now we're doing this educational piece, and we're beginning to tackle research programs where the sort of the research grantee is planet Earth. This whole network of labs is solving the problem, not an institution. So there's a few ways you can think about this in retrospect. At one point, 80% of the world's mills were in Manchester, UK. The rest has been downhill there. They started the Industrial Revolution, but they have a good football team now. We're working with them closely now on this lab network because industry used to be defined by ownership of the means of production. These are the new means of production. This isn't prototyping. This is on-demand, local producing of what you need, where and when you want it. So you can think of this as we're really at the edge of a new industrial revolution. Or another way you can think about this is at the turn of the last century, Carnegie funded libraries. Books were for elites. And he had this idea, everybody should have access to books. So he funded this network of libraries that had an enormous impact. And now, if you're literate, you know how to read, and you know what's in books. And further, if you live in a civilized place, it has a library. That you own books at home doesn't obsolete libraries. It's an embodiment of literacy in the community. And so you can think of this accidental revolution as kind of libraries for a new literacy. Instead of Carnegie, this is Håkon the herder in North Norway, or Kalbag the farmer in rural India, or Mel King, the community activist in Boston. But they're kind of doing what Carnegie did. They're providing access to this new means of literacy. And at the end of this evolution, I came to appreciate all of this is fixing a mistake going even further back to the Renaissance. There's something I just didn't get growing up. When I was in high school, I wanted to go to the trade school where you could weld and fix cars. And I was told, no, you're smart, you have to sit in a room. And nobody could tell me sort of how that followed. When I was at Bell Labs, I tried to use machines to make things and got union grievances. And they said, no, you're smart, you have to tell somebody else to work the machine. And it just didn't make sense. And once I could buy all the machines for myself, I finally came to appreciate that in the Renaissance, literacy emerged as mastery of the means of expression. This was the time of humanism, of the liberal arts weren't politically liberal, it was a path to liberation from the means, which was the trivium and the quadrivium, language, natural science, roughly. So that was the moment when art and artisan separated. And you could study the means of expression for liberation. And then there's this great phrase, the illiberal arts. There was all this other stuff that was just for commercial gain and didn't count anymore. And so that's why welding wasn't considered something you could do if you were smart. What all of these projects are showing is 3D machining and microcontroller programming is every bit as expressive as painting a painting or writing a sonnet, but they're means of expression that weren't easily available back in the Renaissance. And so this accidental viral snowball is kind of embracing this new notion of literacy, creating analogs to libraries for this new world of digital fabrication. And so there's this receding boundary where it certainly takes over just getting people interested in science and technology, but it chips away at things like local problem solving, like the networks in Afghanistan, creating local businesses. It's chipping away at education, things like the Fab Academy. We have very interesting discussions about aid, rather than sending solutions, sending tools to solve problems as a way to get at root causes of some of the biggest problems on the planet. And finally, research. We're working with groups like the National Science Foundation and other national governments on ways you can use, instead of a national lab being one big place, a whole network of little places. In a sense, they're still elite. It's fine, but it's elite over the other 5 billion people on the planet, harnessing the brain power that just will never make it to a place like this. And so there's this rapidly receding boundary. And I'll leave you with the observation that this is really where you come in. The first part of my presentation today was stuff we did, that's research. All of this was completely unplanned. This was this accidental snowball. And what it means is really democratizing and empower the means of research, technical research and education. So this becomes your story, not my story. And many of the questions that come now aren't from you to me, but from me to you. So with that, the book Neil showed has the background to the story. It doesn't have all the more recent stuff. And then linked off of my home site, you'll find this presentation and all the other material I covered. So with that, I'll thank you and take questions.
Okay, so let me just encourage anyone with a question to come up and speak close to the microphone, please.
Hello. Hi, my name's Ronnie Barron, and I enjoyed it immensely. It was great. My question is the universe and the world, is that computing? Is that what you mean by these codes? Like, I don't quite understand it, so if you could clarify that.
Yep, so is the universe computing? The answer is yes at multiple levels. So in this presentation, I described that at maybe three different levels. One sense is as fundamental science. So this paper from Seth is a fun example, and there's a number of related ones. If you take the definition of a computer today and you apply it to the universe, it's a computer, and you can count the number of operations it does and the amount of information it stores. And so by the way you define computation, the universe is a very powerful computer. That shouldn't be surprising, because we make computers, and they're in our universe, so it shouldn't be surprising the universe computes. And so in this fundamental sense, the universe is a computer. Then one step outside from that is you could view the fact that the universe computes as surprising. You could start with the equations of physics and then derive computation. Or you could turn it completely inside out. And you could start with the statement, the universe is a computer. It stores information and it interacts, which you describe as computation. And you can derive the laws of physics as handed down a few hundred years ago from that. And so there's a growing generation, of which I think I'm right at the boundary, where computation becomes the fundamental theory of how you describe nature. And then you recover descriptions that fit on a pencil and piece of paper from that. So that's one level up of differential equations, or these sort of lattice models, are equally fundamental. Then a level up from that is, if the universe computes, it means rather than these architectures von Neumann and Turing taught us, we can make computer architectures now to do word processing and pay your taxes, but do it in a way that reflects the structure of the universe, meaning you compute with a continuous medium where information travels through it. And that's this project to develop better computers I described. And then the final sense of, is the universe a computer, is this parallel between digital communication, computation, and fabrication. If the universe is a computer, it means the output of programs isn't just information, it's things. So that's a roundabout answer to say that it's yes, but yes has different meanings at all those different levels with a variety of consequences.
Thank you.
Hello. I'm Betty from Toronto. And I apologize for my simplistic question, but if machines are going to be able to make machines, how is that going to impact mass production and how people survive this?
So if machines make machines, how does that relate to mass production? There's a very close historical parallel to that question. In retrospect, history is a great guide to everything I'm telling you, even though in advance that wasn't at all apparent to us. So the historical parallel is, look at music. Initially, music, either you played it for yourself or you bought it from the labels. Then along came Napster. There was this brief spike of, yippee, it's free, nobody pays anything for anybody evermore. We got through that, and where we've ended up with is music now exists in markets of 1, 10, 100, 1,000, 1,000,000, 1,000,000,000. There's still music done by labels for giant markets. There's still music you do for yourself, but we now have this wide range of things you do in between. And by definition, in a sense, the music done for 1 billion people is the least interesting. The most interesting stuff musically is this intermediate space. Look at software. Software was owned by Microsoft or IBM. Then Linux came along, yippee, it's free, nobody pays anybody for anything. Now again, we have this interesting space where software is developed for markets of 1, 10, 100, 1,000, 1,000,000. There's still Windows, but many of the most interesting things in software are happening in these intermediate scales. So likewise, mass production will be to make nuts and bolts, things everybody needs, but sort of by definition are the least interesting things. What this will enable is analogs of markets on all these different scales, and as the scale gets smaller, it gets more personal. And there's a concluding observation on that, which is, you could look at all of this and say, that's fine, but it's still not mass production. But that's a historical mistake. And it's very parallel to printing. HP was able to buy Compaq because of inkjet printing. Inkjet printing in HP is developed in Corvallis, Oregon, not Palo Alto. And that's because printing at HP was ranked by speed. And so the big laser printers ruled. And then there was a group that said, well, we could make these printers that would be very slow, but they would be cheap. They would look beautiful, but they would be cheap, and one person could have one. And that didn't rank because it didn't scale. So they went off to Corvallis, and the rest, if you look at HP, the line where they make their inkjet cartridges, it's the closest I've seen to legal counterfeiting. They go ka-chunk, and each one is $30, $40 for, I don't know, a dollar cost. But the lesson was, a lot of low-rate production equals high-rate production. Everybody with an inkjet printer on their desk is printing the same number of papers as the big laser printer that was centralized, but now every one of those pages can be different. And so in the same sense that you open up this whole space in between, it doesn't eliminate big production, but it makes it much less interesting.
Thank you.
My name is Lisa Stanley, and I'm from Waterloo. Whenever a tool of creation is developed, it often attracts power seekers and people that desire to create products that are used to harm rather than help, for example, weapons. Are there any boundaries or regulatory controls that monitor and prevent the Fab Lab from producing such products?
So can you do evil, bad, nasty things with this? So background to that question is all technologies always have been used for good and evil. So there's no reason to expect this will be any different. But there is a fundamental difference in that because everybody can use this, its use is governed by what individuals do, not big entities. So this lab in Afghanistan, I was at two different meetings that had the very same outcome. One was I was briefing a room full of the brightest up-and-coming army generals on emerging research on what was coming. And I told them about a lot of stuff, but I ended with digital fabrication and fab labs. And then the room split right down the middle. Half the generals said, my God, we have to classify this. You know, our military superiority rests on things like information warfare, and if the bad guys get this, we're doomed. But bless them, the other half of the generals in the room said, no, it's too leaky, you can't control it, but further, this isn't for the bad guys. The bad guys already have the best available means. You don't need a fab lab for an AK-47. It's a mature market. This is for everybody else. This is for the kind of the fodder for the bad guys. And you should propagate this, not control it. The same thing happened again. I was briefing, in a similar setting, a panel of the leading members of the intelligence community about emerging technological threats and talk about a lot of things, and then I ended with this stuff. And then there was this wild reaction again, right down the middle. There was a contingent in the room that said, how dare you waste our time with that? We're worried about disruptive technologies and you're showing us 8-year-old girls in Ghana making microcontroller circuit boards. And the other half of the room looked at them and said, my God, if anything is disruptive, 8-year-old girls in Ghana making circuit boards is disruptive, and this is the most important thing we can be doing. So it's a concern, but many of the people who might be most concerned about that on the front lines view it in the same way I do, which is we've been sending weapons to Afghanistan, which isn't working so well. We've been sending aid packages that don't work so well. All kinds of things can go wrong, but this has been very successful, and there's demand for a lot more. And the local Afghani reaction has been along the lines of, finally, here's something we can use. And so I lean towards, you can do bad stuff with it, but so much bad stuff is happening. This is an opportunity to do good. And the wisdom of it isn't up to you or me. It's up to the planet. And I have more faith in that than in restricted organizations.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Gareth. I'm from Waterloo right now. I really enjoyed your talk, by the way.
Thank you.
I'm a computer science student at Waterloo right now, and when you said that using this RALA system, you can do matrix multiplication in linear time, my ears really perked up. So I was just hoping you could give us a little more detail on that, maybe how it's physically implemented.
Sure. So that you can do that isn't new, but it's been sort of buried. In a computer science canon, you separately count space to store stuff and time as operations. And space doesn't count as time. That sort of sounds obvious. And again, this goes all the way back to Turing et al. But in the universe, it's all linked, that there's density and velocity, and each unit of mass is working all the time. So each of these cells is a unit of storage. It's one logical operation. It's a unit of space. It's a unit of time to transit. Now, depending on how you implement it, if you do this directly, it's about 100 transistors per cell to make one of these logic cells. If you virtualize locally in patches at a, with a little overhead, you can reduce the transistor count to order unity at 100-to-1 decrease in propagation speed. So you're within 1-to-2 orders of magnitude of the number of transistors you use to store a bit in memory. But now instead of storing the bit in the memory, the bit is in this medium. So then think about matrix multiplication. The way you multiply matrices is you have elements, and you take a vector, a column, and you place it next to a row, and you multiply all the elements, and then you add them. And so in this world, the time an operation takes is the distance. So a number has to go up a column and down a row. and the distance it travels is linear in the size of the matrix, and so that's where the linear time comes from. Now, in a sense, we're cheating, but we're cheating because when you multiply the matrix in a conventional computer, you still have to store it, and the storage isn't doing anything. It's just sitting there waiting for its turn in the processor. Here, instead, everything is happening everywhere all the time, and so we get to do it. There's some overhead, but the overhead isn't very large. So that observation isn't new. Things like systolic arrays have done that for many years, but those are very special purpose systems. You couldn't do a general purpose computation with it. I have a student, Scott Greenwald, who's now doing a very interesting exercise. There was a time in the emergence of computing when Jack Dungera from Argonne to now Oak Ridge and Tennessee and colleagues developed LINPACK, LAPACK, all the mathematical routines we use. We're now right in the middle of re-implementing them. So that's linear time multiplication. This is linear time sort, where these are comparators, these are switchers. So building these computational structures that do all the algorithms you know, but in this world where computation is propagation. Okay.
Thank you.
Hi, I also have a question about this, the computer architecture. When the time comes when this is used for personal computing in the home, do you envision this looking to the end user the same as computing is today, where they have an operating system and choose an application and run it, or would the end user also really need to know about the physical implementation?
So my guess is where this will come won't be there first. Nothing's broken with word processing, and in fact, the problem with word processing is adding more features you didn't really need. So you don't need this just to word process. Where this is going to appear is places where the computing is breaking. So one place computing is breaking is the biggest machines, these billion-dollar scale machines, where you won't use it directly, but this will go into the data centers that Google uses when you do a Google search or when you use Gmail. So it'll go into things like data centers. Another place, though, this is likely to come into the home is the very opposite extreme. There's an interesting application in buildings for energy. Buildings use 70% of the electricity in the US, and they waste a third of it, about a third. And that's because light doesn't know when natural light is coming in and it should dim, or an air handler doesn't know when you open the window. To do that, every light, every switch, every part of the building has to talk to every other part of the building. And so you need to fill the building with embedded computing. But that doesn't work if all the processors and all these devices use more energy than you're saving. And further, you don't want to have to worry, is it a Mac building or a PC building? Buildings have a lifetime much longer than computer architecture. So one more place where this is likely to come out soon is embedded processors. Because made this way, embedded processors don't have any architectural assumptions, and they don't use energy to do nothing. When nothing's happening, they don't do anything. So my guess is this won't come in the home quickly replacing what you buy today. Instead, it'll be literally in the woodwork, it'll be in the infrastructure, it'll be in the back-end cloud, it'll be sort of in the environment.
Neil, when you were young, you said you wanted to work with welding and the like to begin with, and you eventually did end up getting to do that. So I'd like to know, do you think that if you'd learned welding to begin with, you would have eventually ended up learning about logic automata, et cetera.
Sorry, say it again.
If you'd started by learning welding, you would have eventually developed in that direction an interest in logic automata because there would have been some application or utility that you would have seen? And if so, do you think you would think about the logic automata differently if you'd started with welding, or think about welding differently if you'd started with it instead of the automata?
So, it's a great question. Paraphrasing, if I had gotten my wish and I got to go to the trade school, would that have been a good or a bad thing? Could I have done what I wanted? My guess is if I had gone to the trade school I wanted to, that would have been a bad thing just because everything was set up in every way possible to you went to the trade school, then you went to an auto body shop. And there wasn't an easy exit strategy from trade school. So instead, I think the answer is, it's not clear I would have emerged from that, but instead, something like this Fab Academy, this is still in the early stages and lots can go wrong, but one of the surprises with this was there are this was aimed at, I described Hans Christian above the Arctic Circle, or these kids in remote places. But in addition, in this first trial year, we've had the opposite extreme. I have a student in my lab, Peter Schmidt-Nielsen, who's homeschooled. He just turned 16. When he was 15, he wrote this. This is a hierarchical parametric CAD design tool for Rolla. And my grad students were supposed to do this, but they never did it. Peter came in, and in a week or so, he wrote this hierarchical parametric design tool for this new programming model. He's never had a computer science class, so he's not limited by that. And he's this real programming prodigy. And he's been taking part in this first year of the Fab Academy because he's homeschooled, he's done high school, and he doesn't have a career path. It's hard for him to do re-entry back into a conventional education. And so he's coming to the Fab Academy classes, not because he's a poor kid in a remote place, but just because he doesn't fit. And so I think the Fab Academy is what I would have wanted, but didn't exist.
Siddharth, the computer science student at Waterloo undergrad. I'm wondering if you could elaborate a bit on how code can actually be turned into things without having like a bridge between the code and the machine. You mentioned something about the bubbles and how bits could be transported as bubbles. If you could just elaborate a bit on
that. How can a code become a thing? I can answer in two ways. One way to answer is by what we're developing, but one way to answer is just by invoking past practice, where the past practice is you. So the past practice example is the messenger RNA contains a code that do all the things we know good codes do. It's a lossy code that corrects error, it has redundancy. Then there's iterative programs, and then what comes out of the ribosome is protein folding. And I don't have a picture of protein folding here, but here's our version. So what this is showing is, in this video I showed earlier, there's nothing global. Every one of these elements just has a local piece of information, which is how it wants to be aligned relative to its neighbor. So each one of these elements locally knows what it wants to do, and if every one of those locally does what it wants to do, globally, you make the thing you want to make. So in turn, each of these is a different system. This is DNA, this is nanoclusters, this is microfluidics, this is micro-machined, this is kind of conventional robotics, and these are giant machines. But in each case, this is a 1D string. And the reason it's 1D is you start with a code, but then as part of this project, we had to show that 1D curves are universal to make a 3D structure. And so each of these strings under local control can fold into a global shape to make geometry. And then from there, you can make those shapes interact to implement programming. And so the best answer is these are our versions, but the inspiration is not, it's not sort of slavishly copying biology, but it's inspired by the recognition that biology is based on codes turning into shapes, which control codes, which make shapes. And so a molecular biology textbook read as a computer scientist is a good guide to that.
Okay. Thank you very much, Neil. Before we leave you, let me just remind you of a few things. The next event today is called The Agenda with Steve Paikin, and will be live broadcast at 8 p.m. EDT. Don't forget to check out all the other Q2C events on q2cfestival.com. Thank you to all of those of you here and all of those watching online. This presentation will be available on demand, so please let others know if you enjoyed it and encourage them to visit the website. And finally, the chapter's bookstore is now open at the back of the atrium with a selection of books on the festival themes. So please join me in thanking Neil one last time.